Hey guys, welcome back. Today is the second and final part in my presentation on deinstitutionalization and the homeless problem, how to solve it. In part one, we laid out the problem, the context, the history, the ideology, because you really cannot propose a solution. You cannot propose a solution to a problem until you can fully comprehend the problem. In fact, I would even say that a full comprehension on the problem is in fact the solution, albeit not a spelled out one. So that's what we're going to do here in part two, is spell out the solution to whatever extent that's possible, to spell it out right now, because I'm just going to address the principles of what the solution will be, not the technical aspects so much, which I would argue is a strength, right? The therapy that makes up these institutions, they will all be driven by the same principles. No two sessions will be the same, right? The principles that will be the same behind the institutions, but no two institutions will be run exactly the same. First, you get the principles right, then you can argue over the details, hash those out later on. I mean, if you have a business, what are the principles of a business? Is you make more money than you spend, right? I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out that one. But until you understand that principle, then any discussion you have over inventory or what to keep in stock, it's just going to be a waste. It's just going to be wasted air. You got to get the principles right. Hash out the details later. I would say this is where psychology and psychotherapy are. They're at the business equivalent of not even knowing that the purpose or one of the principles is to make more money than you spend. And then when you point this out to psychologists, to therapists, they don't even know what you're talking about. So that's what I'm going to offer in this presentation, is just the next step. That's all anybody's capable of offering. Anybody who says otherwise, they're ideologues, they're selling some kind of fantasy. And that's what happened in the first, in the deinstitutionalization in the 1960s, is it was a full, complete solution of fantasy. It doesn't work like that. But the next step that I'm going to offer here is going to be big. It's not going to be as big as or as radical as, you know what I'm saying. Okay, so to the outline. First, a recap of part one, what I talked about there, the importance of therapy, why therapy matters the most when you're dealing with the homeless problem and deinstitutionalization in general. And then we're going to go over the parameters for the therapy. What parameters this therapy will need to meet if we're going to have a moral backbone enough to say, no, these people need to be in institutions. Because unless you have a principled approach to therapy, you're not going to be able to say that. You're not going to be able to get away with stuff like that. And then I'm going to talk about some just preliminary ideas I have for the institutions. I mean, my goal here is to just, get enough funds from Gavin Newsom to create a 20-bed institution. So I'm going to apply these principles and we'll figure out the details, but need some ideas for how the institutions are going to be run. So that's what I'll do. Okay. So first, a recap. The thesis of the first video, as I indicated, was the homeless problem exists fundamentally because we don't know what therapy is. And as a quick aside here, it's important to note that I didn't note in the first video, but there's a difference when I talk about homeless. There's a difference between functional homeless and non-functional homeless. These are two groups that often get lumped together under the same category of homeless, but there is a big difference. Functional homeless is the guy who can live and work. He simply doesn't have a home, right? Like maybe he sleeps on his friend's couch. He showers at the Y, right? He lives out of his car. Probably has a job cleaning carpets, but he's homeless. And people often blame this kind of homelessness on affordable housing, which may be part of it. I also know that this kind of homelessness is temporary. You don't really see it. Well, it's only temporary if I would say there isn't some bigger psychological personality disorder, substance abuse issue, in which case, then it's not temporary. It can last for years. So that doesn't really sound like homelessness to me, if that's the case. That sounds more like initiation, right? I mean, just think of Les Miserables. The pivotal part in Marius's development is when he was homeless. He was functionally homeless. He lived with his friend, Comferac, one of them. I always forget their names. Yeah, and that's when he split from his grandfather, right? That's when he made his own way. That's when he became a man, right? That was when he was able to grow on his own and be his own man. That doesn't sound like homelessness, right? That sounds like initiation. And I don't want to do anything about that kind of homeless. You know, maybe people who are affordable housing experts out there can do something about that kind of homeless. That's not what I'm concerned with. That's not the majority of homelessness anyways. That's not the homelessness that you see. The homelessness that you see is the non-functional homeless, the skid row, the guy who makes the whole subway car smell like tinkle. This is the majority of homelessness. And so when I say homeless, I mean the non-functional homeless. And I think when I put it in this perspective, you know, from this, when you make this distinction, it's really easier. It's a little bit easier to see that the main problem is lack of proper therapy. Yeah. So I guess it just makes it more clear that the distinction is lack of proper therapy. I thought I had another point there, but maybe not. Maybe I'll think about it later. And also, it's important to point out, related to this, is that when deinstitutionalization occurred, it wasn't because they had a better idea for care. They, in fact, had no idea. They wanted to take people out of institutions and put them in what they called community mental health centers, which is fine. You know, you can take people out of state-run hospitals and put them in these smaller community centers. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem is the architects of deinstitutionalization didn't believe in care. Right, that what they offered was preventative care, which is code for, well, it's society's fault that you have these issues, so there really isn't much that we can do about it. Right, and if you don't get that is ideologically driven, just imagine, right? Imagine if we did the same thing, if we took the same approach to the medical profession. You know, there was a time when the medical profession with medieval barbers, right, Theodoric of York, that old SNL sketch was, I found really funny. When medieval barbers, when the medical profession was in a worse state than the psychology profession and therapy around 1950, like with bloodletting and something, you know, just terrible. But nobody said, oh, well, let's just get rid of doctors or the idea of treating people medically. Nobody said that. They said, well, let's just keep trying. And it took a while, but they did it. I mean, just to emphasize the point, how ideologically driven it was to start something like deinstitutionalization, to take these people who were mentally ill and not even offer them a choice to stay. You were so upset that they didn't have a choice to leave that you didn't offer them a choice to stay. That's compensation. I'm going to make a point about that in a little bit. And so I think, in other words, this is a side point here, or it's related, but it's important to point out that the deinstitutionalization wouldn't have been necessary if patients received proper treatment in these hospitals in the first place. And when the hospitals did work in the past, when these state-run Kirkbride design institutions did work in the past, it worked for about 15 years, from about 1850 to 1865, and it wasn't because of the therapy. It was because we initially threw a lot of money at the problem. And people who had psychological issues could go there and rest. It was effectively, you know, a giant field day, like in elementary school. Remember that? You got the day off of school and they put people in the different teams from different grades and you gave your team a name, like the Bushwhackers, and you do, you know, like sack races and spoon and egg races, whatever. That's what these Kirkbride institutes were. Which goes to show, just because something can be therapeutic doesn't mean it's therapy, right? There's this guy, there's this therapist who runs a group therapy, and rather than a group therapy, rather than actual therapy, they play Dungeons and Dragons. It's like, yeah, that can be therapeutic, I guess, but that doesn't mean it's therapy. I saw this tweet from a therapist online, and she said that Mother Nature is the greatest therapist. If you really think that, I mean, I get your point, but if you really think that Mother Nature, just spending time in Yosemite Valley, is the greatest therapist, you clearly don't know what you're doing to even make that as a point, right? But that's where therapy is. That's where the field of psychotherapy is. Like I was saying before, it's like at the business equivalent of not knowing you need to make more money than you spend. And so you have therapists who spend years in training, to eventually say, just go to Yellowstone. If you really believe that, then you would stop being a therapist and, yeah, move to Yellowstone, become a park ranger. If you really believe that. Or are you kind of joking? Or, you know, look, I know I have a stick up my ass about this stuff, but this stuff really matters. If we don't get this right, we're not going to have the moral backbone. We're not going to create the kind of, I would argue, anti-fragile system that's really going to give people who are severely mentally ill the treatment that they need. And so society runs much better. I mean, it's not just I'm not pretending like I'm just doing this because I'm this great humanitarian. I want society to run better too. And it's not going to run better if we can't distinguish between somebody who poops their pants and knows that's a problem versus somebody who poops their pants and thinks like, well, who cares? I'm just going to go hang out at the library. Right. Okay. Anyway. So I get it. You know, given how impotent therapy is and given, you know, what I was just saying about how therapists will say, oh, Mother Nature is the greatest therapist, or let's just play Dungeons and Dragons. You know, given the impotence of therapy, I understand when I say that the root of the issue is therapy, it doesn't make any sense. Like, what? Who cares about therapy anyways? Like, can't you just play Dungeons and Dragons, whatever? You know, yeah, do your, what's that horse tranquilizer? That's like a party drug that people take. Ketamine, you know, do your ketamine therapy. And I actually tried to talk to my uncle about this. And so I put it in these terms, and I think this may help understand how important the therapeutic aspect of this is. Imagine if we didn't know how to treat a broken leg, a broken bone. I guess any broken bone, I'm just going to focus on broken legs. Imagine if we didn't know how to treat broken legs. People would break their legs and they would probably just live with their family. And they would probably be a burden on their family. They wouldn't be able to do much work. They had to do some work around the house, but they'd mostly be in pain, mostly hobbling around. A lot of families wouldn't have the resources, the psychological, the economic resources to give these family members the attention and the care that they needed. So eventually a lot of these people would end up on the street or in institutions maybe. Yeah, let's just go in chronological order. They would end up in institutions, but even in the institutions, they wouldn't be getting any care. Right? Sometimes the legs would heal. If the fracture was less serious, it may heal on its own. And the institution would probably take credit for that. But most of the time it wouldn't. Or it wouldn't heal, or it would heal improperly and you would just be a gimp the rest of your life. The ACLU types would come along and rightly say, and they would have a very good argument to say, well, you can't keep these people in here if you're not treating them and they have no way out. You know, we need to let these people live on their own. They wouldn't be able to do it. You know, it'd be very difficult to live on your own if you had a broken leg that wouldn't heal. You would be out on the street more likely than not, you know, doing fentanyl to ease the pain of your dysfunction that nobody knows what it is. Right? And so this is why deinstitutionalization happened. Not because we found a better way, but because there was no way. People said there was no way. And as I said, you know, Thomas Hayes came around, Myth of Mental Illness, and said the neurosis does in fact not exist. The broken leg does in fact not exist. It's society's problem. Or you just need to learn how to get a job. Let's teach you how to get a job. Right? Side note here, isn't it interesting? You know, the nature of compensation, because I think if you really want to lay out a good solution of this problem, you need to understand how we got to this problem in the first place, right? Through compensation. And we fought World War II effectively, which was a big reason why deinstitutionalization happened. You know, we looked at the atrocities of World War II and we looked at what we were doing to people who were mentally ill, and public opinion began to grow that, like, yeah, you can't keep people locked away. It's just really bad optics. So it's interesting, I think, that we fought World War II to end these religions of empiricism, utilitarianism, the idea that you can do some calculation and say, oh, you know what? It's better for society to keep certain people locked up. We just did that calculation, and that's how we're going to, and that's okay to do. We fought World War II effectively to say, no, we're not going to do that anymore. America was doing it too. Eugenics, right? You can probably do some calculation with eugenics. You can't really. You think you can. And say it would be better for society to chemically castrate a certain group of people. But no, we don't do that. Not okay. Don't you understand the year that it is? But because we still have that same incomplete epistemology of empiricism based on the metaphysics of materialism, we still end up putting people in camps. Open air camps. Now we do it under the guise of morality, but whatever. Whenever we put people in camps, it's under the guise of morality. That's what utilitarianism was. It was under the guise of morality. And you think leaving people in Skid Row, you think leaving people mentally ill is any different than the atrocities of World War II? Yes, it is different, but it's not different by enough. It's not nearly different by enough. This is a good note on compensation that we need to understand if we're going to propose a solution here. And so, and I think the other mistake that people make when they're trying to propose a solution is they say that it's a legislative problem, right? It's not a therapy problem. It's just a legislative problem. There's too many laws passed since the institutionalization, too many legal precedents that make it basically impossible to treat people who are mentally ill for any serious length of time enough to treat them properly. And yeah, it is. Well, we do have those laws, and they are a problem, but we need to understand that we wouldn't have those laws in the first place. We wouldn't have had deinstitutionalization in the first place if there wasn't principal treatment for the mentally ill. Okay. It's like you can't start a government commission to build bridges when you don't really know how to build bridges. When, yeah, you can build some bridges and it'll stay up, but you can't really explain why. The big difference is the amount of time you spend building the bridge, or the amount of man hours, or the amount of materials you use. Oh, yeah, you kind of figure out more materials you use, the higher the chances that the bridges are going to stay up. You know, yeah. Try asking the government for money and creating a sustainable system based on that kind of lackadaisical, you know, philosophical approach. You're not going to do it. So you can say, once we get the legislation correct, then we're going to, you can say that in order to solve deinstitutionalization, we need to get the legislation correct. That's true, but it misses the point. Okay. So let's go into the parameters for the therapy, and yeah, these will be the parameters for the therapy. Then on the next section, like I said, in the outline, I'm going to go into more of like a brainstorm of how the institutions need to be run. But these parameters are pretty much need to be set in stone, and you'll see why. Okay, so the first parameter for this therapy is the therapy needs to account for how the unconscious or something that exists outside your conscious awareness that affects you. You need to understand what that thing is, what its nature is. I call it the unconscious. Maybe you call it something else. And you need to understand how that affects us. I say it affects us, our thoughts, feelings, beliefs, our behaviors through emotions. It doesn't have to be that. But whatever you say those two things are, this thing that exists outside of our conscious that affects us, and what is it exactly that affects us, until you can look at the nature of these things and apply it to therapy, it's not going to matter. That this is vital. We need to concede that there is something that is affecting you. So you can't just say like Thomas says and say, oh, well, yeah, you just don't have a job. We got to teach you how to get a job. No, you can know how to get a job. You can know the right thing and still not do it. And unless, and the just the existence of the homeless or any other kind of neurosis, your procrastination is emblematic of this. I mean, work with homeless people. Have you worked with homeless people? The most fascinating thing about it is after a few days of being off the streets or being on a certain type of medication, it's amazing how lucid they can be. Maybe they're not doing well, but they can be lucid and they can see what they're doing. And they can say, I don't want to be living like this. I know I have a mental illness. Which is why, I mean, you know, so many people with schizophrenia end up committing suicide once they're on the medication because they see how distorted they are. Yes, I see I have an estranged relationship with my daughter. They don't want that. They don't want that. And so you need to understand the severity that an unconscious, something that exists outside of us, can affect us. And you need to be able to break it down. Right? Neurosis is not, this is unconscious integration is what I think the issue is, right? And neurosis is precisely, it's not, you know, it's not like, I mean, it's not your will. It's not free will. It's the absence of a will, not its expression. I mean, homelessness is really just an extreme version of what we all do to varying degrees. I mean, really, when you look at homelessness, for whatever reason, I really think it's just a way to keep your life small so it can be, you can have a semblance of control. Now, maybe you want to keep your life small because, you know, you're schizophrenic, whatever, and that's, you know, you're not going to function well. And so you keep your life small for that. So it's like a chicken and egg thing. But that's one way of looking at it. And I think that's what we do. Like, you don't relate with that? You don't relate with the idea of keeping your life small? So you maintain a semblance of control? So you can seemingly control how other people see you? You can't relate with that? So I think that's important to get first. That there's this unconscious that exists that affects us. It affects us in some way. You need to know what the unconscious is, or whatever you call it. You need to know what the thing is that affects us and how it affects us and how to apply that to therapy. Don't tell us, by the way, don't tell us the content of the unconscious, because that's religion. Just how it works. What is its nature? How do we communicate with it? How do we relate with it so we can influence it? I guess that's like the 1A parameter, is we have to be able to influence the unconscious in some way, right? I mean, if you can't concede to that, then there's no point to therapy in the first place. And maybe we can't influence in a typical way that we would think of influence or control or anything. Maybe all we can do is relate with it, which I guess would give us better influence over it, but it's not, you know, influence in the way that we typically see it. Okay. I feel like I'm rambling. Parameter 2, the therapy is a conversation, and so accessible to anybody who can have a conversation. And if the therapy cannot simply be a conversation, if it needs to be something more, then it's not going to work. Now, it can be more. Like, you can do like art therapy or storytelling or something, but at minimum, it needs to be a conversation. And whatever technique you use, is just a way to facilitate the conversation. That's what therapy fundamentally is. It's a conversation between two or more people. Now, some people say it's a relationship, but we don't have a relationship without talking. You got to break it down on a conversational level. It has to be specific. Now, there's of course going to be abstraction in the therapy, but if you need to rely on the client, the patient, the inmate, whatever we're going to call them, if you need to rely on them for the abstraction, it's not going to work. Now, they can do it, but a lot of people can't do that. So you need to break it down on a conversational, what do you talk about? How do you talk about it? What are good words to use when you talk? We're not going to tell you the words that to use, but we're going to tell, like, here's some good guideposts to look out for, good words to look out for here. You know, people say stuff like, oh, well, what do the words matter anyways? You know, conversation or communication, 90% of it's subtext or it's something besides words. Or it's like, yeah, only 7% is words. First of all, I don't even know how you calculate that in the first place. That doesn't make any sense when you think about it. I know how you calculate that, but it doesn't matter. Even if it's 1% words, doesn't matter. I mean, what percentage, I mean, yeah, it's fitting that this meme is a skeleton. I mean, what percentage of your total weight is your backbone? It can't be more than a few pounds. I know the spinal cord doesn't weigh much. It doesn't matter. It's your backbone. It holds you up. You got to get the backbone right. Otherwise, nothing else is going to function. It's the same. You know, words are the backbone of the communication, of the relationship. You got to get the words right first. These are fundamental parameters. Yeah, so there needs to be a conversation, and it needs to be accessible. It needs to be broken down on a concrete level. Again, the therapist will need to handle some of the abstraction. And, you know, based on the mental capabilities of the client, you adjust for that. But we'll talk about that more when we get to the institutions. Okay, so that's the second parameter. The therapy needs to be a conversation. It needs to be broken down. It needs to be explained on a conversational level. I mean, that's one of my issues with IFS, not the internal family systems. Not that there's anything wrong with it. I see a lot of good in it, but it just doesn't break therapy down on a specific enough level. Yeah, you have these issues, and it shows, and it has your names for all these issues, but how do you talk about it? How do you work your way through it? Is it just seeing it? I don't think that's going to be enough. I think you need to work your way through it. There needs to be a definite process. So yeah, parameter 3 is a corollary of the first two. So it should really go without saying, but it's important enough, I think, to say that the therapy itself is the growth. If the therapy is somehow disconnected from any kind of real-world growth, if it's not the growth itself, then you're not going to, it's not going to work, right? I mean, obviously, it's just not going to work in the way that you want it to. I mean, like I've said a million times, because it's true a million times over, we don't have relationship problems. We don't have money problems. We don't have family problems. You know, we don't have work problems. We don't have a problem with our boss. If you think that's your problem, you know, it's a delusion. You have psychological problems that manifest in these various areas. Everything that needs to happen happens because of the therapy. Well, because how you talk in therapy is the basis for an improved relationship with others, with other people. Not just with other people, but other things, other institutions. Because it brings clarity to your issue. When you can identify your issue, when you can identify the problem as covered in the first parameter, when you can identify that, you can bring clarity to it. You can begin to see where your issue ends and somebody else begins, another institution begins, a boss begins, any kind of authority figure, you begin to see where they begin. And if you can't do that, then you're not going to be able to live. You're not going to be able to work through this issue and become part of society. How do you do this? Well, I think you do it by identifying principles of the unconscious, like I was saying, because that's what affects us, and how it affects us is through emotions. So you need to identify principles of the unconscious, principle of the emotions, and this tells you how to break down, like, what to talk about in therapy and how to talk about it. Now, I'm not saying that this is the therapy that we need. I'm not saying to use my therapy. I'm saying mine meets certain parameters I think that a therapy needs for these institutions to work well, for psychology as a field to have the moral authority to say, yeah, this person who's pooping on the street, yeah, we have the authority to say, no, we got to take care of you. We're not saying, oh, you live how you want, because neurosis, like I was saying, or I stuttered through before. It's not an expression of the will. It's an absence of the will. The other thing that this parameter does that I brought up in the first video is... Do you guys hear that? One second. All right, so there's some noises outside. So the other thing that... this parameter does, when you say the therapy is the growth itself, is it solves that split that I talk about in the first video, the split in the Renaissance between, well, you see it there, science and values. the split between rationalism and empiricism, the split between mind and body, between awareness and action. You know, what I don't want to hear is it's not enough to sit around and talk about your problems. At some point, you have to get off the couch and do something. No. Then that's not growth. Then the therapy becomes something else, and you lose that authority. If talking about the problem isn't the something you need to do, then you don't understand what the problem is, and you're not able to talk about it correctly. And I don't know, maybe this is just one... this is just one objection that I thought of. Nobody's really told me, but maybe somebody would say something like, well, why do we even need to figure therapy out on this level? I mean, can't we just take these people and put them in rehabs? I mean, we already have rehabs. And this is like the legislation as the problem people. This is what they think. We'll just put them in rehabs. We could do that, first of all. But when, again, you have to understand, when the therapy isn't working correctly, it quickly overloads the system. As we saw when we first tried institutionalization with the Kirkbride floor plans, buildings and institutions. If you don't get the therapy right, it easily overwhelms the institution. Yes, I guess we could just hypothetically take people off the street and pay for their rehab. That would cost a lot of money, and I don't think anybody's going to do that. It's not really solving the problem fundamentally. It would be way more of a short-term solution. And yeah, I mean, come on. We have people in Ukraine to kill, so we're not going to spend money on that, right? But the joke is, like, yeah, I mean, that's a joke, but it would just be a money pit. And I think because we're still so bristly about the atrocities of World War II and how that was reflected in how we were treating people who had mental problems, I think we're so bristly about that, which is good. I want us to be bristly about that. We're not going to be able to do this properly until we can really nail down, right, just like starting a government commission on building bridges. You're not going to be able to do it until you can explain fully, here's the engineering principles behind building a bridge. And yeah, speaking of rehabs, maybe something else somebody is thinking is, well, what about psychiatry? Will this be part of the therapy? Yeah, but I mean, yes and no, right? I mean, psychiatry, that's a different field. That's medicine. Psychology isn't medicine. I think this is part of the problem. I think just because so many people would even be thinking of that as an objection, that's exactly part of the problem. I don't think you're hearing me if you say that as an objection. And maybe I know I need to maybe speak more clearly about this, but you're not really hearing me if you say, well, what about psychiatry? How does that get involved? I mean, basically what you're saying there is, well, what about a library? I mean, shouldn't these institutes have some kind of library? Yeah, maybe, I guess so, but that's not the point. That's not the foundation. Yes, of course, people need, especially, you know, people have severe mental illness. They need to be medicated. There needs to be a psychiatrist on staff. That's not what I'm proposing here. Psychiatry has come. There's still big problems with psychiatry, blah, blah, blah. A lot of medications are overprescribed. Da, da, da. I get it. But psychiatry from 1950 has come a long way. Therapy hasn't. We're still struggling. And we're still struggling to find some principles here. Okay. Yeah, and I guess that just goes to my whole point about it. I mean, one of the problems with psychology and the reason why we're not looking for these principles is because we're trying to treat psychology like it's a hard science. And it's not. Maybe it will be one day. But right now, we're not even close to that kind of technology. Yeah, maybe it will be one day, and then we don't have to have this kind of therapy anymore. That's great. But until then, we need to understand principles for speaking through what your psychological issue ultimately is, what it fundamentally is, as it is. All right. Okay, so now to the institutions, ideas for the institutions. So just this is mostly going to be hypothetical. Like, again, I want Gavin Newsom to give me money to start a 20-bed institution. I'll work the kinks out. But we need to start somewhere here. Some of these ideas I'll start with. But the main point is, before we get, I guess, but this is part of it, I guess. Maybe this should be in the therapy section now I'm going through this, whatever. there's still one big problem. Even if you have a therapy like I'm going through that hits all those parameters really well, and you have a, you know, people who can give inmates, give patients, not good therapy, good enough therapy. The main problem is cost, right? Is how do you pay for these therapists? And I think the natural outcrop of a principled approach to therapy is the therapist becomes less valuable. Right? Yes, you do need training, but not as much as when there are principles. I mean, you really don't. It's so much easier. I mean, you know, I did training before I had these principles for how therapy is run, before I was able to break psychology down to a conversation, to apply the principles of psychology that I have in my first book, The Unconscious, what it is, how it works. Again, not the content, but what it is, how it works, emotions, what they are, how they work. Yeah, I kind of had that in my head when I first started working, when I first started my training. And man, it's like being a therapist is really exhausting when you don't have a conceptual framework for the client's issue. I mean, I really think without principles, no amount of training is ever going to be enough. And with principles, I would say conversely, no amount of training is ever not enough. I mean, you know what I mean? It's really easy to get the training in. I think you'd still need to go to school for therapy. It'd be more like a trade school. Yeah, you don't need to go to school for 8 years to learn how to change an oil in somebody's car. Now, you can go to school for 8 years, and maybe that would make you better and give you like a better approach. But if you just want your oil changed, making somebody go to school for 8 years to do that, it's ridiculous. I get it, right? If you have like an 84 Porsche collectible, whatever, and just like, you know, it just needs to go to the right guy who's maybe been to school for more than 8 years. I get it. But this is not fundamental at all to what therapy is. Yeah. And like I've said 1,000 times on this channel, because it's 1,000 times correct, when you have an integrated approach to the field, therapy no longer is something that you receive from a qualified therapist. It becomes something that you're able to give yourself once you understand what therapy is. Once a therapist is able to take you through that process. A therapist is essentially the ballast. You need it, but they're really interchangeable. It's not like the specialized thing of you need to go to this one therapist who gets you. Once you have principles for the field, all that goes out the window. Just go to anybody. How do you choose a guy to change your oil? Just probably go to the closest one. Now, it's not as simple, as concrete as changing an oil, but it's going to go more in that direction. I don't know exactly how these institutes will be run. I just want to plant the seeds here. I just want to plant the seeds. Who knows what happens? I mean, maybe part of, and I think a lot of this is going to be locally controlled. I'm going to get into this next with the ideas for the institutions, but maybe part of it, now that I'm thinking through it, is the inmates, maybe that's how they work their way through the system, through the institute, is to begin to give therapy themselves and begin to help somebody else through this process. Maybe, I don't know. But the point is, you need to create some kind of system where, you know, it's, yes, it bends. It bends when you put a certain amount of stress on it. That, you know, that's inevitable. It's going to bend. But after a certain point, it doesn't bend anymore. It just holds it, and it bends, it never breaks. And I think when you understand a principled approach to therapy, drives the cost of therapy down, and just, you know, what people makes the therapist less special, which is how therapy needs to be, right? So right, because therapy isn't the goal. Therapy is the stepping stone. Being in this institution isn't the goal. Maybe it will be for some people who are just too far gone, and they at least have to stay in the institution maybe for a while, but I'll talk more about that right now. Okay, so these ideas for the institutions, and some of these are taken from Kirkbride Institutes, how he envisioned it. I thought he had some good ideas. The first one is, I think that these mostly need to be locally controlled, if for no other reason than to keep a, you know, plurality, right? The principles are the same. how the principles are applied or will be different given different contexts in different cities. I just imagine these being run by the county. You know, like if you have a county library, you have a county mental health institute like this. And that was the huge irony with the community mental health centers is it was like the marketing is like, these are going to be more local, but the funding was federal. So it actually became a federal program. And so you lost the ability to test out different theories in different ways and, you know, create some kind of synthesis between two different ways. You know, something greater becomes greater than the sum of its parts. We didn't have that. You don't have that when everything's federally funded. At the most, I think that these should be state funded, that the state should give all of them the same money. There should be no incentive like, oh, if you cure more people, you get more money. No, none of that, because that just creates this bureaucratic nightmare and you're placing the incentives in the wrong place. The only incentive that needs to be in place is incentive for the individual inmates. Right? They need to live and work, and I say self-sustaining. I think the original plan for these Kirkbride Institutes, which easily became overwhelmed, and so they stopped doing this, was the inmates need to live and work. A lot of them were on a farm. Okay, they do farm work. The inmate needs to figure out, I mean, there are certain roles, of course, like maintenance, cooking, cleaning, whatever. The inmates need to make themselves useful and make money. And I'm not saying you have to work in the institution. I think this will be something that you know, this is one of the details that will be figured out. I mean, maybe like, look, if you can just make money through the internet, through, I don't know, monetizing your Twitter account, then good for you. God bless. Maybe you don't have to work in the institute, but you do need to pay for the therapy yourself. Yeah. I mean, that's a huge problem. The cost. Well, I think having a principal therapy drives the cost down. Well, you need to pay. You need to pay for the therapy yourself. And I get it. You know, if you hear, because of, we're still traumatized by World War II. So if you hear patients need to work for their freedom and you're thinking, prison labor camps, then I'm sorry. You just have, you know, pop culture bromides in your subconscious in lieu of an epistemology. And you're just not ready to tackle this problem. And as far as the sentences go, you know, I think they would be mostly based on, I mean, how I would start it is I wouldn't base it on the time you spend in the institution. I would base it on that. If everything I say about the therapy is true, if those parameters are in place, then it wouldn't be the time you spend in the institution. It would be the time you spend in therapy. How long these sentences would be. Again, I think this should all be locally controlled. Different cities have different sensibilities on how this needs to be taken care of. You know, in San Francisco, they would say, yeah, you can walk down the street with your pants down. So what? Des Moines may have a different idea about that. You may get, you know, 30 hours of outpatient treatment in Des Moines if you did that. You know, I think there would be a difference between inpatient and outpatient. Outpatient would be very much run like a halfway house. You know, I mean, like one time I saw this lady, I'm sure I've talked about this before, this is back when I still did New York, I was walking down 73rd Street. And this was right after de Blasio released more inmates, and it was noticeable. I mean, it was bad up until this point, but it really became noticeable afterwards. And I saw some lady, you know, projectile diarrhea-ing all over the 73rd Street, you know, broad daylight. It was splattering on the nearby car. I would say if you do something like that, that would be probably 30 hours of inpatient, maybe 100 hours of outpatient. I would definitely err more on the side of high recidivism. So yeah, it's easy come, easy go. It's easy to come in, but it's easy to come out. And yeah, that's just the nature of working through psychological issues. Is right on average, it takes about 7 tries in rehab to work through an addiction, not just a drug or alcohol addiction, but like any kind of, you know, serious, like anorexia, something like that. It takes 7 tries on average. So yeah, you know, you're just going to be exhale, inhale. It's just going to be this natural process. I was like, oh, here you're back in. Okay. We still have some more work to do. It's not about punishing, right? It's just about, we can't have society run if There are people pooping their pants who come into a public library. And nobody knows what to do about it. The cops can't do anything about it. Not anything sustainable. I mean, they can come and move him out, but he's going to come right back in. Right? It's very difficult to have a society unless you have those things in place. Right? And as far as testing is concerned, I'm not going to go too much into that. There's a lot of good reality tests and tests for malingering. I think, again, the main test is, and the main idea of these institutions needs to be, they are self-sustaining. They are a fabricated society. And if you can't make it through this fabricated, the society on training wheels that is the institution, you're not going to make it out there. So you just got to make it through, got to put in your hours of therapy, provide for yourself in some capacity, and yeah, you're out on your own. You'd probably be back, but that's okay. I'd rather err on that than the other side. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the huge problem with deinstitutionalization. I mean, the problem with institutionalization is they couldn't leave. It was so difficult for people to get out of there. But when they did instigate deinstitutionalization, as I mentioned in the first presentation, they didn't give them the choice to stay, right? I already mentioned that, but that's just like fascinating that we would think that just indicative of that. You just don't really know what you're doing. And yeah, look, I get it. I get that there's probably a lot of red tape and bureaucracy. And I know that the lobbying that the nursing homes have, the lobbying power that the nursing homes have, and how much they've made off of, you know, how much government money they've gotten because of deinstitutionalization. It's going to be, you know, I'm not saying that this is going to be an overnight thing, but again, I just say, give me 20 beds and we'll work out the kinks and we're going to make it better. Not going to make it perfect, but it's going to be better. And it's going to be something that we can work with work the kinks out, test. But you have to have principles there to work with in the first place if you're going to do something like that. So that would be my call to action, I guess. What am I saying here? Yeah, my call to action here is me as an Anunnaki just spreading the seeds of civilization. I just want to plant the seeds. And this is just one proposal for how this could work. You know, my kind of therapy. I want there to be other proposals, like I said, and I want to see how they're doing. I want to be able to talk with them and, you know, create some kind of synthesis or some, you know, third better way. Then the big picture here is, look, this isn't just about mental health hospitals or mentally ill. This is about other things too. You know, like what we did with mental illness and deinstitutionalization in the mid 20th century, we're doing that with other crimes now. You know, like how Thomas Addison came around and said, mental illness does not exist. We're doing the same thing now, like with shoplifting or theft, right? People are saying, oh, look, it's a societal injustice that people even need to shoplift in the first place. So we're not going to prosecute it. What they're saying is that shoplifting isn't a crime, right? Shoplifting doesn't exist, not in any serious way that we're going to take it seriously as a society. And we need to understand that we need better arguments. You know, the people who understand that you can't have people with poop in their pants walking into libraries. Now, somebody who comes from the epistemology of empiricism, the metaphysics of materialism, they would say, well, what's the big deal? Just some guy is pooping his pants. I mean, what's the economic cost? Yeah, there's no serious economic cost right there. I mean, first of all, there is a huge economic cost because it does add up. But, you know, you just can't really function as a society. Likewise, you can't really function as a society. Yeah, I'm sure Target can afford to have their stores looted every once in a while. That's not the problem. The problem is you make it that much harder for stores to be open. Maybe a place like Target can afford it. Some other places can't. It just sets a really bad precedent for society. But in order to do that, we need to, I'm not saying like conservatives need to fight back. It's not about that. It's just people who understand that concepts exist need to have some moral backbone when we argue for those concepts. And you can't do that unless you think in principles. You can't just say, oh, look how bad it is that people are on the street. It doesn't move the needle. it gets people who already agree with you to agree with you more. Why we have, you know, that's why we have a coming apart problem, one of the many reasons. Okay, so yeah, that's it. I mean, if you want to learn more about how, you know, my view of psychology, how it meets those parameters, my view of the unconscious, how it influences us, how we can influence it, get my first book, joinanimus.com/book. There's a link to the Amazon page. If you want to find more about the therapy that I do, joinanimus.com/schedule, just reach out to me. But yeah, really what those parameters are about, what I was trying to say, and what, you know, when you say that the therapy itself is the solution, what you're really seeing is, and talk about your problem until you get enough clarity around it. So much clarity that what you need to do to work on that issue becomes obvious. Not what you need to do, what you're able to do to work on that issue becomes obvious. You need clarity and process. That's really what it comes down to. So again, joinanimus.com/schedule. Thank you guys. Let me know what you think. You know, put something in the comments there. Send me an email. mark@joinanimus.com. And I wish you all the joy and pain that comes from submitting to the principles of your psyche.